Hey friends, what's going on? Welcome to the Astro Hustle. I am Corey Allen, and I am glad and grateful to be here once again, speaking with you, sharing brain stretches and, thought wiggles and all that type of thing. How are you doing today? I hope that you're doing good, that you're feeling right, and that all is going well in your life, and that you're feeling good energy coming through, and are you ready to take on this current moment of now? I've got a great guest on the show. The guest is my friend Jamie Wheel. Jamie is an author and the founder of the Flow Genome Project, and he's got a new book out called Recapture the Rapture. I had a pleasure of getting an early look at it. It's really great. I know you all are going to enjoy it and what we get into in this conversation. My friends, I'm very happy to say that this podcast is brought to you by Upstart. When it comes to paying off debt, it can often feel like an uphill battle. High interest rates resulting in minimum monthly payments keeps you in an endless cycle of debt. And I would say it's designed to do that on purpose. However, Upstart can help you get ahead, and that's a good thing too, because whenever you're in debt, barely meeting those payments, that is a brutal, heavy feeling that really takes up a lot of your mental real estate. But Upstart can help you get ahead. Upstart is the fast and easy way to pay off your debt with a personal loan all online. Whether it's paying off credit cards, consolidating high interest debt, or funding personal expenses, over 500,000 people have used Upstart to get a simple, fixed monthly payment. Unlike other lenders, Upstart looks at more than just your credit score, like your income and employment history. This means they can offer smarter rates with trusted partners. With a 5-minute online rate check, you can see your rate up front for loans between $1,000 to $50,000. You can receive funds as fast as one business day after accepting your loan. Find out how Upstart can lower your monthly payments today when you go to upstart.com/astral. That's upstart.com/astral. And don't forget to use our URL so you know that you are a true Astralite. Loan amounts will be determined based on your credit, income, and certain other information provided in your loan application. My friends, this podcast is also brought to you by New Calm. Those of you that listen to my show know how important mindfulness is to me and that meditation has been a part of my daily routine for decades. So New Calm gets you into a deep, transcendental meditative state every time, no matter if you're just starting your mindfulness practice or you've been practicing meditation for years, New Calm will allow you to make the most out of your mindfulness sessions. New Calm is the only system of its kind, clinically proven in over 1 million sessions to improve your sleep, reduce your stress, and boost your recovery without drugs or side effects. Now, I tried New Calm, and I really do believe I could feel it changing how my nervous system was operating. Make 2021 the year you become more mindful. You go over to Astral New Calm, that's AstralNUCALM.com, and get 50% off your 30-day subscription of New Calm and their money-back guarantee. Once again, that's AstralNUCALM.com for 50% off your first month. All right, my friends, the time is now. Let's go do it. Let's go get into the flow with the great and wise Jamie Wheel. You use the word rapture in your new book, which I think is really a powerful word, but it's one of those words that's multidimensional. It's got a lot of different entry points and people think about it in a lot of different ways. How do you think about the word rapture as it relates to your most recent work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's at least two distinct definitions that actually kind of overlap to support the thesis of the book. So the simplest way that to think about it is kind of uppercase and lowercase rapture, right? So lowercase rapture is just like rapturous, like the idea of filled with bliss, filled with intense pleasure, filled with inspiration. And for me, that, that kind of goes back to William Butler Yeats, in his poem, The Second Coming, where he says, "The best lack all conviction, while the worst are filled with passionate intensity." And taking a look at the world these days, you can see an awful lot of people passionately convicted that are absolute fuckwits. And they've hijacked the mic from our collective conversation. And we're getting pulled to the extremes on both sides of the political spectrum by folks who really don't have the interests of the collective commons at heart. So in the titling of the book, the first is, how do the rest of us, how do the best of us who are currently lacking all conviction recapture our own personal passionate intensity, our rapture? And that includes healing, right? Where we're traumatized, where we're numb, where we're isolated, where we're fragmented from each other. And also our passion and our conviction and our courage and our creativity.
So wherever you say restoring the collective commons, or that those are being kind of hijacked and misaligned, how do you think about the collective commons of people, you know, in an age where, of course, the bias echo chambers and the just the reinforcement of one's own opinions is so intense thanks to the wormholes and algorithms of the internet? How do you think about, you know, something that complicated and that complex in an era where all information is pulled into every possible direction?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like it's the middle that's complicated, you know, like at the lowest level of our families and the ones we love, right? Life is pretty simple. We're a bunch of tribal primates trying to get on, you know, trying to kind of solve the monkey puzzle of existence, that life is nasty, brutish and short and red in tooth and claw. And holy shit, we have access to sonnets that make us weep, and we can split atoms and send, you know, rockets to Mars. And so, and on the highest level, we're just a bunch, you know, nearly 8 billion hominids on this little blue marble hurtling through space. And the oceans are our commons, the mountains, the forests, the rivers, those are all our commons. And we all deserve, regardless of political affiliation, religious beliefs, you know, or social identification, I can't think of a single parent, at a minimum, that wouldn't say, hey, clean water, clean air, clean soil are our collective birthrights, and we're all better off for them. So it's the middle part that you described. Right, the social media, the culture wars, all the noise, the politics, the geopolitics, the factionalism and tribalism, that's the stuff that's sort of needlessly complicated in the middle. Mm-hmm. But that bigger perspective, the kind of pan back and here we are, you know, 8 billion, you know, hominids on this little blue marble planet, the great, you know, the late great planet Earth, that one's pretty straightforward. It's just a lot. It's a lot to hold. And in order to hold that truly and simply, it's that Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, he's like, I wouldn't give a fig for the simplicity on this side of complexity, but I'd give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity. And that simplicity on the other side of the complexity is we're all in this together. So let's figure it out.
Yeah, it's interesting as it turns into kind of like a feedback loop where you have, you know, the people in their discrete individual lives living, you know, just basically as you described, trying to take care of themselves and their families and, you know, the small part of community that they may be connected with. There is a simplicity in that and a very direct human experience, a very organic, you know, aspect of that. Of course, the conceptual framework that is immensely increasingly dangerous, the sort of buzzing hive mind of gnashing, the new digital gnashing teeth of reality that has kind of turned into this fear, terror, self-interest halo around our species. Is now what's interesting about it is that now it's the feedback loop has been created in that people are living these discrete individual lives, however, in pockets and in chunks of their own experience, dipping into this halo of terror and then feeding it or being influenced by it. And what happens is that it then strengthens that, and then that giant halo then comes down and externally influences the people who are living those, you know, the organic quality of life. And so that shift, like a fundamental existential shift in experience slowly starts happening, like the tide slowly starts coming in, without people really realizing it, right? Because they think, oh, well, my reality most of the time is just me here doing what I do, getting dinner ready, taking care of, you know, my friends and family. But then I'm going to go, you know, tap into this thing, not really realizing that slowly they are changing the entire playing field. Now, how do you think you could get someone who's simply just trying to, you know, make rent to focus on that and to understand that idea?
Well, when you say dipping into this thing, what are you thinking of?
I mean that they're living their, you know, normal, organic, healthy life-ish, and then they're taking that a hit of digital chaos by going on to, you know, going into the online portal and getting influence and adding and receiving. As I said, all the while that online hive mind is then shifting the entire playing field.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a couple of points there. And then we should also come back to the second definition of uppercase rapture as well. But the first is, you know, I think this was just past 50 years ago was the famous Summer of Love, where Tim Leary said, you know, tune in, turn on, drop out, you know, and that was his kind of rallying cry for the psychedelically inspired boomer generation, right? And so we've had a half century of that experiment, and it didn't really work too well. You know, we ended up into the 80s and Greed is Good and Gordon Gekko, and we ended up in, you know, late stage capitalism and all sorts of things where the descendants, the children of the boomers, specifically millennials, and then coming up on their heels, Gen Y, is like, wait a second, man, you guys looted the store and you've left us with a, you know, a bill come due with interest. So you could almost, you know, first of all, just invert Leary's invocation. You could say, instead of tune in, tune out, you know, tune out the digital distractions. Instead of turn on, like turn off your screens. Instead of drop out, you know, drop into our bodies, drop into our lives, drop into our families, our communities, our relationships. And so when, you know, you're referring to that digital hive mind, that kind of collective fibrillating shit show, turn it the fuck off. Like, we're not sovereign to our own mind spaces when we're being hijacked by AI machine learning algorithms that optimize for rage, that optimize for hate, that optimize for fear. You know, Yuval Harari, the fellow who wrote Sapiens and Homo Deus, I mean, he said something that has stuck with me. He's like, this is his voice. I don't even read articles, let alone, you know, memes. He reads books. If he's interested in a subject, he'll read a book on China. You know, he won't read the latest news headline. And so that notion of, you know, there's been a slow food movement, there's been a slow music movement, there's a lot of great, there's a slow sex movement, there's slow everything movements these days as our lives accelerate. But I think you could have a slow thought movement, which is, you know, back off the constant dopamine, you know, crack loop of social media and just settle in to bigger picture, longer term, more informed sense making. So that would be step one, right? Like, first, just literally digital detox. And it can be super simple, you know, like park your phone, to charge your phone in the kitchen and go to bed and literally read a book. Like, I have found, like, in the last few years when my nervous system has been getting sort of super amped up, that picking up a book while you're in bed, you know, obviously the sort of 15-minute window before you fall asleep, it's actually tactilely soothing to hold something in your hand and look at symbols on a printed page. And it can be fiction, it can be non, whatever, like whatever lights you up, do that. And just spend that last hour of consciousness not looking at a screen. And the same thing in the morning, just make a pledge. And it's a little weird during quarantine, but make a pledge that you sort of don't pick up your phone until you're heading out the door or starting your day. So, like, allow that transitional, don't use your phone as an alarm clock, you know, have it downstairs, get up, shower, bathe, be in your own mind space, not checking to see how many messages or likes or clicks or tweets you got right away. And I don't know who that was. I want to say it's BJ Fogg, but it could have been somebody else. But they were basically saying, hey, if you want to check to see if you're digitally addicted, even slightly, just kind of run an analysis of how far away from your body is your phone at all times during the day. And if it's less than 8 feet, you know, you're an addict. Right? So that would be step one. But to your point about, you know, just the kind of everyday person trying to make rent, trying to deal, you know, not everyone has to become a Gandhi. You know, we don't have to have a bunch of bodhisattvas. We have to be kind and gentle to ourselves. And there's a sliding scale of who we can look after and who we can look out for. And it kind of ranges from myself now, like me now. If I'm hungry, cold, tired, hurt, then me now is all I've got capacity to do, right? But if I lay on all the biohacking, all the performance optimization, or even just a basic, you know, healthy life, I've got enough sleep, food, nutrition, rest, focus, then my cup overflows. And then I can care for my family, right? And then it's me and mine now. And then if I've got enough juice left over and I have a thriving family unit or key relationships, then I can start caring for and even leading my community and then even my country or even the world. And that's a sliding scale based on resources and environmental conditions and goals. So if I get whacked on the head with a hammer, then suddenly I'm back to me now. But if I get more and more resourced, I can be like, hey, my people, me and mine, now. And next, I can start planning for a future for us. And then it eventually expands all the way to a Gandhi, a Mandela, a King, a Bodhisattva kind of perspective of everyone, everywhere, every when. We can honor our ancestors. We can honor the people alive today. We can even be taking actions based on those not yet born, right? And that's a sliding scale. And it depends on energy, vitality, stability, and resources. And it can go up or down depending on the conditions.
Now, do you think that there's a way to get a kind of ahead of the big picture macro suffering that people are feeling from all the things that you laid out at the beginning? You know, because typically, like with most types of suffering, the only way or any, you know, really social discomforts too, any way that someone moves into action is typically internally motivated by their own suffering, their own discomfort. And whenever, you know, they have to kind of get to this place of almost hitting rock bottom in a way of maybe this digital overwhelm or disconnection or loneliness or whatever it may be, only then to seek some type of relief that can bring them above sea level to the place that you're talking about. Do you think there's any way to, you know, in this world of extreme communication, which I mean extreme by highly connected, to try and kind of get ahead of that, as opposed to just letting everyone go through, you know, or just the only way being everyone just going through this long, protracted journey of pain and disconnection? Because ultimately, if you look at it in the big picture, figuring out some way to help people wake up to that sooner might be a way to preserve the entire collective from experiencing a longer timeline of this type of disorganization.
Yeah, well, I mean, and just to kind of ground our conversation, because it feels like we've kind of come in with a sort of shared, like a presumption of some sort of shared context. So for some listeners, like, what on earth are these guys talking about? I think it would just be as a baseline that it appears that we are probably already into a meta-systemic crisis globally. And that meaning, meta just meaning a bunch of or kind of above the specifics. So it's not simply, you know, climate change and ice caps and polar bears kind of thing. It's not just current culture wars in the US or Western Europe. It's not just macroeconomics and supply chains. It's not just global pandemics, et cetera. It's all of them bundled together. And they have knock-on effects that can, you know, occasionally cancel each other out, but quite often amplify each other and destabilize things further. And so to your point there, I mean, there's a concept known as the Stockdale paradox from Admiral Jim Stockdale. And he was the highest ranking POW in Vietnam. And so he was there, I think, for 6 or 7 years, maybe even longer. And he noticed something about the other U.S. prisoners of war, and it was that the pessimists didn't make it. No surprise, right? They succumbed to grief, despair, and they kind of gave up their will to live. But the thing that he noticed was, like, wait a second, the optimists didn't make it either. The Pollyanna, like, the boys will be home for Christmas or Easter or July the 4th or whatever it would be, and then those dates would come and go. They had nothing underneath it, and they would just crumple. And so the paradox that he articulated was that the key to thriving and surviving is to be ruthlessly realistic about short-term realities, about present reality, but relentlessly optimistic about long-term possibility. And, you know, the poet and MacArthur fellow Wendell Berry has a beautiful line where he just sums this up. He says, "Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts." Right? So you know, to kind of look, to combine those two, you've got Oliver Wendell Holmes and you've got Wendell Berry. And, you know, so the Oliver Wendell Holmes was, "I don't give a damn for the simplicity on the set of complexity," right? But you can kind of mash up those two quotes. We shouldn't give a damn for the joy on this side of complexity, right? That's sugar high consumer distraction. But we should be willing to give our lives for the joy on the other side of complexity, right? But that will require facing all the facts. And so, you know, a buddy of mine, Dr. Zach Stein from Harvard, he's a super wise dude. And he just hipped me recently to the notion in Jewish Kabbalah of three phases of existence: the pre-tragic, the tragic, and the post-tragic. And the idea is that most of us, when we're born, we're kind of kids, we're sort of buying the social scripts and norms, you know, sort of anybody can grow up to be an astronaut or president, you know, I get to live my hashtag best life. All of that is very much the pre-tragic phase. It's unlimited opportunity, possibilities. There's no sense of constraint or injustice or randomness to the world, and the world is my oyster. And then, you know, life invariably kicks the living shit out of us. You know, tragedies, divorces, miscarriages, business failures, sickness, illness, accident, war, you name it. And then we get sucked into the tragic. And for most of us, that can break us. We can just end up just for, you know, sort of sucked down the drain of the tragedy of life, undigested grief. But there is a third path, there's a move, and the move is into the post-tragic. And that's what you see in the gospel, blues, jazz, soul tradition. You know, I'm going to rise up singing. My heart has been broken open. I'm not whistling past the graveyard. I'm not pretending that much grief and suffering and pain is a part of my experience or our shared experience, but I'm going to sing anyway. And to me, that's the move, right? Is can we get to, you know, there's that old, you sort of see those bumper stickers on Subarus and Teslas in the Whole Foods parking lot, you know, think globally, act locally, right? But we might even want to update it. It's like grieve globally. Thrive locally, you know, like take in the wound of the world, take in the stakes of our condition together, but then turn that around and bring love and light and joy and courage and creativity to our right here, right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me, and I agree that the most, you know, I think, flexible, healthy, and promising mindset, although difficult to achieve sometime or just take some time and patience, is one of being equally rational yet positive, and not necessarily optimistic, because optimistic suggests that one might askew away from data to just think, no, regardless of what the data says, things are going to go all right, but rather being reasonable and realistic and pragmatic, but being positive about what you're finding. You know, I think that that's a really, indeed, a healthy way to move forward. This kind of pulls me into thinking about the staying alive and the coming alive curves.
Yes,
that
me
you
too,
talk
dude.
About.
I was just thinking that.
I got my vaccine the other day, so now I can see, you know, since I've got a chip in me, I can see your internet history and all your thoughts and all that stuff. So
sweet patent number 666.
Yeah, exactly. So could you talk about those staying alive and coming alive curves?
Yeah, I mean, you know, literally, I this one was not a complex theoretical assumption. This was me being up at night several times and being like, wait a second, I am in a schizophrenic, should I go blind situation where I'm like daydreaming or shooting the moon about what's possible in our life. Like, where do we go and what adventures do we plan? What beautiful entrepreneurial creative ideas? What projects can we launch? What, you know, all the kind of possibilities of coming alive, right? What is the expansion of life, joy, novelty, community, all of these things? And then, and this has been, you know, very much so, especially in the last couple of years. And then suddenly, like, needle across the record and being like, wait a second. Do I even get to think these thoughts? Do we even get to plan these kind of things? Because there's the staying alive arc. And that's the sort of, holy shit, do we need to triage what we're up to? What's possible? Do we have infinite time, resources, and possibilities? You know, so it's sort of like, if you think of the coming alive arc, if you think of this kind of like life's a picnic, you know, life's a picnic at the beach. The coming alive arc is, well, where should we put our blanket? And what yummy food should we pack in our hamper? And, you know, and who should we invite? You know, and it's kind of, it's all about the expansion of options, possibility, and enjoyment, basically. Hashtag best life, right? Mm-hmm. And the staying alive arc is sort of like, oh, wait, look, the ocean's getting sucked out to sea. Wait, all the animals are fleeing to higher ground. Like, hang on, what's that blaring tsunami warning on my iPhone? And you're like, holy shit, we got to run for higher ground. And it feels like we're approaching the intersection of those two curves. And to stand there in the middle of it going, holy moly, things are getting exponentially better, right? This is the, you know, increases in nutrition, increases in standard of living and literacy, the beautiful, everybody gets a, you know, a smartphone and global Wi-Fi and, you know, and all these kind of things, the kind of Steven Pinker, Hans Rosling, TED Talk realm of abundance. And holy smokes, things are getting exponentially worse. You know, racism, sexism, fascism, all the isms, fires, Ebola, COVID, you know, all the things. And how do you map exponential curves that are crisscrossing and crashing all over the place? It's, you know, it's typically, it's, it exceeds the capacity of humans as we're currently wired, right? E.O. Wilson, the Harvard biologist, said we have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technologies. And certainly during COVID, you know, every other op-ed piece was like, hey, it's really hard for us to wrap our heads around exponential change, like literally not linear, like not let today is a little bit more than yesterday, but exponential. And the classic is how many lily pads cover a pond, you know, and on what day of a 30-day month, you know, is the pond half full? And the answer is, you know, day 29, you know, and that just melts our brains. We can't ever guesstimate that. Or how long does it take for a flood to fill a football stadium? Like those kinds of questions. And so we're not wired to be able to wrap our heads around the intersecting exponential curves of coming alive and staying alive. So
yeah, it's interesting is that it's all like we're wired for it to be professional time discounters because, you know, 200,000 years ago, it was most important that we ate right now. Instead of if someone said, hey, I've got some a line on a nice, juicy, decaying leftover carcass that a higher predator ate that's about a mile away from here. If you want to pass up this little, you know, rat that you're about to eat, it's going to take a few days, but we can get there and then we'll have enough food for a month. People are designed to go, no, whatever, I'm going to eat this rat and we're just find another rat tomorrow. And it's weird. I know that's a really weird analogy, but it's crazy is that we're still deeply wired into thinking that way, which I think is why we have such a hard time conceptualizing or intuiting rather what you're talking about.
Yeah. And certainly, in fact, Phil Zimbardo, who's also at Stanford, and wrote a book called The Time Paradox. And he came to him when he, was an exchange professor down in Brazil, and he could not figure out, he'd like have a class and the class would be empty. And then like 15 minutes before the end, a whole bunch of people would like roll in, stroll in, sit down, and then they'd hang out and chat with him for an hour afterwards. He's like, what the fuck is it with you people? You know, and he sensed, oh, wow, there's different cultural time signatures. And there's future oriented, which is typically kind of, you know, US, Western Europe, that kind of stuff. There's present oriented, and there's different, like literally relationships to chronology. And what does it mean to be quote unquote on time? What
is like having dinner in Italy, man. It's like, it's going to be 3 hours, and it's hilarious to see people who expect you to like dip in and dip out and have dinner in 35 minutes, you know, trying to eat in France or Italy or something, where it's like, no, it's, that is the meaning. That is the evening. It's like, it's not, you know, rushing to go eat real quick and then have a whole bunch of the spectrum of entertainment. It's like, no, the moment of being there with the other person, that's the entertainment. That's the purpose and where the meaning comes from. It's such a beautiful way of life to me, but it's interesting how that can be confused by people who are living in the same day and age, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Ilya Prigogine, who's the physicist who won a Nobel Prize, he wrote a beautiful book called Time's Arrow. And it's just that notion of like, oh, how do we hold, like, what is the passage of quanta, of just units of time? And, you know, this is a gross reduction, but in general, you can say that, you know, modern and linear societies became more focused on time's arrow, a past, a present, a future. We're planning, we're anticipating, we're doing these things. And time as a cycle, Uruburus, you know, the snake that eats its tail, is more true of indigenous societies. You know, there is less sort of progress through time than there is simply the repetition and the reinforcing and the witnessing of cycles. And if you're in forever a cyclical loop, then there's no desire to go and be or do or change anything. You're on the ride, and it always comes back to the same point versus past, present, future. And there's some, you know, there's some interesting scholarly arguments that would suggest that that notion of beginning, middle, end, or beginning and end with a line connecting them is a relatively uniquely Judeo-Christian invention, which then permeated the Western world and then permeated the rest of the world, which was the Alpha in the beginning and the Omega at the end. And so as a result, that really became the bedrock of Western thought and the way we perceive reality. And as a result, it's also led us to a lot of utopian thinking and philosophy. So it's like, as we run smack dab into this meta crisis and we look around for answers, there is an overwhelmingly strong temptation to fall into, and this actually nicely brings us back to the capital R rapture definition, right? We started with lowercase rapture. How do we reclaim our passionate intensity, right? But the uppercase rapture is that, you know, in the beginning was Eden, then there was a fall from grace, then there is a redemptive spot in the future, and after that redemption, then everybody who is among the elect or the saved, right, is better off than ever, right? Paradise restored. And John Gray, who is a professor of European intellectual history at the London School of Economics, wrote a book a few years ago, which has totally, as far as like, I always pay attention to what books or ideas does my brain keep popping up to the front and use as a helpful unpacking. And I think Tim Wu, the fellow who wrote The Master Switch and coined the term internet neutrality, like that book, bad to the bone. And I think of it, you know, multiple times a month. But this John Gray book, the Black Mass and the Death of Utopia and Apocalyptic Religions, blew my mind, because he's like, look, this is such an entrenched story, this utopian rapture ideology. It has its underpinnings in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the Alpha and Omega, but it shows up constantly through history, including godless versions. So it doesn't always have to be religious. Communism was exactly the same, right? We were in a pre-agrarian state. We then fell into industrial capitalism, right? The proletariat gets repressed. Once we have the communist revolution, right, that's the rapture point, then we will live in a collectivist utopia. And you suddenly, the moment you see that, you're like, oh shit, so neoconservatism, where Bush and Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld were like, oh, we're going to topple all the baddies in the Middle East, and there's going to be an Arab Spring and an uprising of democracy and McDonald's for everyone, and free trade, by the way, right? That'll happen. No, it didn't. You know, what about blockchain and crypto? Then we'll get rid of fiat currencies and the nation states will collapse and we'll all be trading our wallets. Yay! You know, or psychedelic renaissance or neural implants and a technological singularity. You're like, oh shit, we are up to our ears in rapture ideologies. And they're not all wearing sandwich boards and clanging bells saying the end is nigh. You know, sometimes it's the singularity's near. And they feel, you know, this goes back to Stephen Colbert and that, White House press correspondents dinner where he was taking the piss out of George W. You know, it feels truthy. You know, we feel it in our guts and we're like, yeah, that's right. It's going to happen. It's all good. Or a new age rapture. Like, hey, we're all going to raise our consciousness and we're just going to vibrate to the fifth density and we're just going to peace out from all the problems we're experiencing, right? If you could just keep your vibes high and your heart open and not succumb to fear. By the way, we're running a retreat at our new Costa Rica, you know, pad, and come on down, you know, or let's go to Bali until the wheels come off. So we are unconsciously, like as we experience the grief of the meta crisis, right, and we're getting sucked into the tragic mode, we can become really, really susceptible to anybody peddling a rapture ideology which promises to bypass this current train wreck. But instead of us moving into the post-tragic, which is, yes, you know, back to Stockdale, the paradox there of the POWs, right? Instead of us moving into, like, we accept our current situation, but we still retain hope, not a whistling past the graveyard hope, not a Pollyanna hope, but a radical fucking hope, right? We've got rapture ideologies that are actually promising a return to the pre-tragic. You can have everything. You can be anything. You're special and important. And whether this is like alt-right nationalist and identitarians, like you feel downtrodden, white, poor white male guy. You know, you can be put back at the top of the heap and wear a Viking helmet, you know, or QAnon, you are on the side of light versus dark and you can save the children, right? Or SJWs, we can remake, right, a multicultural society where the most dispossessed are now the most empowered, right? All of these things are potentially regressive moves to the pre-tragic, right, by peddling rapture ideologies by any other name. And they're wildly problematic because they all are 1%er solutions, no matter how they slice the 1%.
Yeah, it's all the symptoms of the worst symptoms of the hangover of the intense Western individualism that is like, you know, extremely prevalent in America, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So we have about 10 minutes here. So I want to get us on to some
yeah,
solutions.
That's chapter one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to move forward to some solutions here. Or maybe do a part two sometime, but getting into some solutions. Your Alchemist cookbook that you put forward is full of nice ways to start, I think, filling your own cup, let's say. So starting with barbecuing the sacred cows, I dig that. How do you suggest people barbecue the sacred cows, and what is that?
Just give me some steer there, because the barbecuing of the sacred cows, I think, is part of that be ruthlessly realistic about present realities, like what are the things. But if we wanted to talk about tools to you know, boost our inspiration, healing, and connection, we could kind of transition to that.
Yeah, whatever you like. Just casting a wide net there, I'm thinking, you know, how can people identify? You have to realize that you're entranced to a god before you can barbecue it. How can you identify your invulnerable sources of knowledge and then learn to wake up from them and think for yourself and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first is that, you know, sort of we all deserve to experience a full spectrum of states of consciousness and reality and inspiration and insight. So the first is, you know, check your buckets. You know, where are we in our allocations of, hey, have I experienced deep inspiration lately? Have I had the time or the capacity or the support to engage in deep healing? And do I have connection or community so that I can feel supported as I conduct those two things. And so most of us, you know, ideally that's an equilateral triangle, right? We're more or less kind of balanced between inspiration, healing, and connection. But for most of us, our triangles are getting wonky. You know, they're isosceles triangles where we're like long on one of those, but short on the other two, or it's a scalene triangle, which is a kind of all out of whack and lopsided and therefore not that strong. So the simplest is, I think, that, you know, if we have laid a critique of the kind of utopian rapture escape, the happily ever after, and we don't have to deal with the shit in the middle, right? The, you know, at least where I'm coming from, you know, living life, having a partner of 30 years, doing our level best to raise kids, bury parents, do all the things. Life is irrevocably tragic. You know, we know that much. But from time to time, it's also magic. And that's easier to forget. And when we get to experience the magic of life, the transcendent peak states, we often experience what the Greeks called anamnesis, you know, which is sort of the forgetting of the forgetting, or a sense of deep remembering of like, oh shit, I remember this. I've been here before. Like, yes, this all makes sense. And when we then invariably come back from that peak state down to the valleys of our life, fuck, we're back in the tragic again. Holy shit, this is crazy. And we kind of toggle back and forth between those. Like, I am a golden god, you know, like in Almost Famous. You're like, I'm on drugs, you know, and that can break us. Because we often are tempted to be like, oh, well, fuck the tragic. I've just glimpsed the magic. I'm going to camp out up here. I'm going to change my name. I'm going to quit my day job. I'm going to move to Bali, Costa Rica, you know, Peru, whatever, or start a new retreat center. I'm not going back to that stuff. But that back and forth, you know, that dialectic is then stabilized by the laughing with each other, the comic. Like, can you get a load of this? Like, what an impossible thing this human experience is. So the tragic, magic, comic, like if we can weep for the tragic, if we can worship the magic, and if we can laugh at the cosmic joke that is our lives, that's the comic. And if we can do that together, then we have a chance to keep on keeping on. You know, there is no away. There is no specific ripcord or exit that absolves us of this human condition. Like if you spend too much time in the tragic, it crushes us, right? The burden of life, the nihilism, the despair, right? If we spend too much time in the magic, it burns us, right? It shorts out our circuits, you know, and our brain, you know, we start just drooling from staring at the burning bush too long. But it's with each other, right? It's the shared burden. It's what Ram Dass said, right? Of like, we're all just walking each other home. Like that feels like a way through this. And it feels like the only way, and it feels like the always way. It hasn't ever been different than that. Mm-hmm. It's just that 21st century folks, globally connected, we are overwhelmed with sort of the blessing and the burden of much, much more information about all of this, and therefore much more responsibility and duty to act.
Totally. Yeah. And I think that comes from, I mean, the answer to all of that is realizing, releasing the attachment to your own sense of self and identity to a level to where you see that living in Bali or living in Oklahoma or being a millionaire or making, you know, $10,000 a year, it's actually all the same experience.
Yeah. I mean, and that's why, you know, the thing that I feel most comfortable with is sort of like, if it gets more fancy pants than like front porch rocking chair wisdom that your grandma would sign off on, you know, we're probably out over our skis, you know, right. And I'm blessed with getting to spend time with people that are so smart and so intelligent. And they're talking about complex metasystemic existential risk and analysis and social physics and et cetera, et cetera. And so many times in those conversations, I think, okay, maybe, you know,
but
it feels like we're entering an era where, you know, physics trumps metaphysics. Like you can be a libertarian, you can be a blockchain enthusiast, you can be an anarchist, you can be any, you know, any ism. And you're sort of like, well, we'll see. Because I think reality is kind of rearing its head. And we're just running smack dab into the consequences of generations of choices. And it will be what it will be. and my philosophies don't matter a damn. We're just going to be on the right. We're just going to be having to adapt to real world situations. And whether that forest fire is because a pyromaniac kid over the weekend, you know, threw his cigarette in the woods, or it's a complex result of global warming, isn't going to matter a damn as I throw all my things in the car and pack the kids and try and haul ass down the highway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that the notion of it will be what it will be is really tapping into what I was just talking about, is releasing the attachment to your idea of how things should be and need to be, and just approaching and integrating what is happening in the present moment and working with that, with all of your toolbox that you have, you know, because that keeps you from getting trapped into, you know, there's the notion of reality tunneling.
Yes.
Yeah. Just pulling out of that. And realizing that, you know, that perhaps reality is a bit more flexible and unknown than we like to agree with ourselves that it is not only liberating, but it's very healing and freeing, and allows you to really move in the moment a lot better. So before we wrap up here, one of the other aspects, you know, we skipped a lot, of course, because there's not, we don't have 10 hours to go over each and everything, but, you know, we've talked a lot prior to this, but one of the ingredients of the Alchemist Cookbook is music. We never talked about music before. So, I'm just curious, wrapping up, what type of music do you like, and what are some of the kind of artists and things you're drawn to?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, and funnily enough, that it ended up becoming the chapter in the book, because what I realized when I looked at my playlists is that they were sort of, it was split in two, right? There was like, and I came up through like old school, you know, bluegrass, newgrass, like the Colorado kind of mountain scene was very much like psychedelic bluegrass. So it was a lot of like old school, like 19th century folk songs and gothic stuff, and also just fun ass jams. And it was everything from, you know, Jerry Garcia and his kind of influences on that world. And then everybody else who was kind of like in the, you know, ganja mushrooms and skiing and, you know, and climbing and like that kind of culture, which was a sort of island, right, from, you know, Reagan era, you know, Clinton era America, right? It was kind of carrying a light. So that was what we kind of came up in. And then, you know, and then sort of dipped into the Burning Man scene and kind of got introduced for the first time. Like, I'd never been interested in electronica. I always thought it was like super soulless, you know, so give me like stringed instruments and skins and drums and various things that felt rootsy. And then there was like, oh shit, you know, this isn't music you listen to. You know, you set up a Function One sound system and you pump out all these wild ass sounds. This is like an acoustic water pick for your soul. You know, it's just you're experiencing the music as sound waves through your body. So it's like, so for me, there's kind of like two buckets. One is deeply transcendent, often lyric-less music. Sometimes it'll, you know, quite often with violin, cello, some things like that, and quite often like ethereal, a woman's voice most often, and sometimes kind of angelic sound. So that's like very much transcendent soundscapes, right? That can sort of serve as the wallpaper of your mind for any kind of, for any kind of sort of state induction and journeying. But then the core, and I think this is what's really crucial and a hopeful way forward, is like if we're trying to kind of recreate meaning that can work for everybody, that's not a singular tops-down solution. You know, the answers are in our texts, the answers are in our songs, that they are living scriptures. And we talked about that for a moment, which is like this American tradition, which is deeply international, deeply interracial, and baked into suffering, triumph, and tribulation, right? All of those songs. So like, this is the rest of my playlist. My rest of my playlist is, it's Dolly Parton, it's Bob Marley, right? It's you name it. It's someone who is singing that same song, which is, I've been down so goddamn long, it seems like up to me. You know, it's the songs that take us through woe and lament and heartache and loss. And then you're down into the mud, and then it starts picking up. And then comes like the triumphant refrain, the chorus of like, we're still here. We're still standing. We are making art. We are testifying. And then it goes from the Ram Dass, we're walking each other home, to actually we're dancing each other home. You know, instead of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee that Mandela stood up to process the grief of South Africa, like it's the Groove and Reconciliation Committee, Because at the end of the day, right, like there are those moments, and this used to happen in Grateful Dead shows, right? Everybody would ingest a psychedelic. They'd start the show, and the first set was very much this. It was Americana. It was like old songs about train robberies and sheriffs and getting stuck in jail and hard luck and deals with the devil and all these kind of things, right? And then set break would happen and everybody would be peeking and it would be all really weird because there wouldn't be any music and everybody's like, you know, it's like right. On the grass, like looking at their hands. And then the songs would kind of come up back up and then they would launch into these beautiful, spacious carrier waves for everybody's journey. And it was like, you know, and it's like going down the road feeling bad and suddenly like you're still busted open. You're grieving in some way you didn't know it hit you. And then suddenly you'd feel the pulse. You know, you'd feel the groove and then people would start standing up and dancing and you'd be like, oh shit. And like strings on your arms and legs and you'd start standing up and there'd still be tears and snot dripping down your face. And you'd be like, oh fuck yes, this is us. This is possible. And we can do this together.
Beautiful.
And that, right. And that's the whole thing. You know, it's like singing to remember, you know, dancing to forget. Like, this is how we do this thing.
I love it. I love it, man. Hey, well, thank you so much for coming on the show and great job in the book. I can tell you put an immense amount of research into every sentence and every paragraph. So great job, man. Thank you.
Beautiful, man. Thanks for having me, Corey.